Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is episode 79 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast with a big-name interview show every Monday, like this one, and short 4 or 5 minute daily episodes released Tuesday through Sunday on a show that I call This Day Rocks. As always, I thank you for hitting play. Now, my guest for today's big interview show is a man with over 50 gold and platinum records to his name. He's worked with so many of the greatest musicians of all time, absolute top draw legends. He's been Rod Stewart's friend, guitar player, and songwriting partner since the 70s. He's recorded the famous, iconic solo on the number one hit from Steve Harley and the Cockney Rebel, Come Up and See Me, Make Me Smile. He's worked with Elton John, Bernie Taupin, Willie Nelson, Joe Cocker, Queen's Roger Taylor, Traffic's Dave Mason, Roger Chapman, John Wetton, Cat Stevens, Katie Melua, Kid Rock, Glass Tiger, and so many more. He's been awarded 3 ASCAP awards for outstanding songwriting, and he played in front of 3.5 million people on Copacabana Beach, which is in the Guinness Book of World Records as the staging of the largest outdoor concert in history. It's been an incredible career, and I can't wait for you to hear a tiny slice of that in this interview with Jim Cregan. Now, we talk about the solo on that number one single, how hard it was to leave Steve Harley to join Rod Stewart, how Rod wanted to continue the feel of the Faces with this new band, his highlights with Rod, some of his production work, including directing the legendary Etta James in studio, and much more as well. Plus, we chat about his own band, Cregan & Co, and their new Christmas song, which is raising money for an important charity. So please, enjoy my interview with the brilliant, light-hearted and humble Jim Cregan. First of all, looking around your room, I see some lovely guitars behind you. I mean, are there any special ones you could tell us about just right now?
The one that's behind me there, that one, that's an old Martin. That's and that's the my go-to acoustic guitar. That's been on all the acoustic guitar work I've ever done in the studio. From Come Up and See Me, Make Me Smile to I Was Only Joking, you know, lots of successful records it's been on. It's a beautiful guitar.
Oh, wow.
It's not the I had a really fancy one, the G45, but I found myself not using it, always going to that one.
Wow. How old is that then?
About 1970.
Incredible stuff, stuff. I love hearing things like that. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Jim, today here on Vintage Rock Pod. You're joining us to talk about a Christmas song, When a Child is Born, your cover of Johnny Mathis' song, of course. Now, you've done this with Cregan & Co, your band, and you've done this for a special charity, haven't you? So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so a year ago, about this time a year ago, the founder of the charity, which is called Angel Force USA, which is a suicide awareness program, especially for American veterans, but pretty well it works for anybody who's at risk of suicide. And she said, "Why don't you do a Christmas song? And we'll put it up in, you know, part of the promotion for the charity, which is kind of ongoing." Mm-hmm. I said, "Yeah, great." So I sat down and listened to loads and loads of Christmas songs, and the one that I liked best was When a Child is Born. I didn't really want to do one of the kind of hymn ones, you know, Come All Ye Faithful, even though they're great songs. I thought this one spoke to me. And so I went ahead and got the guys together and recorded it, sent it off to my friend Anne Dunsmore, the founder, and she said, "What's this then?" I said, "It's a famous song. It's When a Child is Born." She said, "It's a bit like the cheese sketch in Monty Python." "Not around here it isn't," she said. So it turned out the one Christmas song I chose wasn't a big hit in America. So it was like starting from scratch for them. So they put it out, but nobody paid any attention to it because they didn't recognise it as one of their traditional tunes. So a few months ago, and I met with her again, and I said, "I think I ought to put it out in England rather than worry about the America and see what we can do." And that's when we figured out we should. I sang the bridge at one point, and then Ben Mills kindly. We have 2 great singers in our band, mm-hmm. Ben Mills and Sam Tanner, and Sam sang most of the lead on this, and then Ben Mills comes in. I was a bit cheeky. I wrote a bridge for it because as Johnny Mathis talks in the middle of it, and that's one of the things I find really hard to duplicate. And it feels a bit kind of, you know, I'm not that thrilled with people talking on records. You're supposed to sing, you bastard. So I wrote a little bridge to get rid of that bit, and Ben sings that. So it's both of the singers in my band.
Wonderful stuff. Well, you mentioned Ben and Sam there. Talk about Cregan and Co. then, because it's about a decade or so you've had your band running now. Talk about the guys involved now and what you do.
Well, it started off some time ago with the idea that the songs that I'd written with Rod and songs that I played on ought to be, we should feel comfortable going out and playing those tunes, because I had a lot to do with them, like 20 odd years of work with Rod. And I'm involved in a whole bunch of those hits. So we started doing that, and then it gently sort of started to morph into something not quite as Rod Stewart orientated, although it's still quite a large part of our repertoire. Mm-hmm. And we rearrange them. We don't do them necessarily like the record. Sometimes we do, depending on what we feel like. And we've got our own album out, which is called Spreading Rumours. And that's nearly all original material. And any money I've really made in this business has been as a writer. Yep. So, I mean, there's another wall here which is full of platinum records, but the computer's facing this way. I've, as a songwriter, I've had some good moments, you know. Those...
to put it politely, absolutely.
So that's what we're doing. We go out and we play. I should explain. I don't really love the idea of lots and lots of travel. I'm a single dad. Mm-hmm. I have a wonderful 17-year-old daughter called Ava, who's at school here in Christchurch, and I don't really want to be away for great lengths of time. I mean, I've done all that. I've been around the world, you know, half a dozen times, maybe more, and I don't want to miss being around for her, you know, and put somebody else in, you know, one of the family members or something. So we play concerts, we play theatres, festivals. And generally, I'm rarely away for more than one night, and she, you know, she can cope with that. But now and again, I have to go to America and do stuff for the charity, which I'm doing just before Christmas. That'll take me away for 10 days. But I've got her cousin is going to come and stay here and look after her. She doesn't really need looking after. She's 17.
I was going to say, she probably needs a little break from her dad.
She'll be building a rocket in the back garden.
Fantastic stuff. just to reiterate, When a Child is Born, get your hands on it now. It's a fantastic version that Cregan and Co. have done. Jim, it would be remiss of me not to talk about your fantastic career. You've mentioned your gold and platinum discs, and we had a little chat about your guitar behind you. I just want to start quickly with something from one of my listeners, though, Dave Alcock. And he's a listener of Vintage Rock Pod for a long time. He's a huge fan of the band Family, a big fan. He's been wanting me to get Roger on the show for a long time, and I'm trying my best to track him down. But just for Dave, who listens, can you tell me a little bit about your time with Family and what it was like working with Roger?
First of all, I was with Family for a couple of years, and I was brought in, strangely enough, to replace John Wessop, who's a wonderful, who's an old friend of mine and a wonderful bass player. So that came down that Family and one of the bands I was in called Blossom Toes were very good pals back in the, I don't know, the early 70s, I suppose. And Polly Palmer, who played drums in Blossom Toes, went on to play vibes and flute in Family. So we had a large connection going on there. Connection, I suppose to say. When John Weeder left, they said, do you know any bass players? I said, I've got this fantastic mate of mine, John Wesson, you should give him a try. So they tried him and they loved him. And he's a wonderful musician and a fabulous bloke. So then he got a better offer for loads more money to go to America, which is, you know, the bass players are a bit like the drummers in Spinal Tap. They're always blowing up or leaving or something weird. So they'd had about four bass players before John came along. John left and Charlie Whitney, the guitar player, phoned up and said, John's left. Oh, I said, I'm sorry to hear that. So he said, well, it's your fault. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you're the one that recommended him, so it's your fault. I mean, if you hadn't recommended him, we'd still have a bass player. I said, there is some logic in there, but I'm having trouble with it. He said, I think then maybe you ought to play bass. I said, I'm not a bass player, I'm a guitar player, you know that. I've never been a bass player. They said, well, you are now. I said, I don't even have a bass guitar. They said, we've just bought you one. So that was it. I was the bass player. And I've had a wonderful time. Great people. Tony Ashton joined at one point when Polly Palmer left, and he was one of the funniest humans I've ever spent any time with. So it was a very happy band. And Roger, to work with Roger Chapman he's a very interesting man. He's very complex. He has a whole sensitive side to him that allows him to be a lyricist and a writer. And he also is a tough guy as well. He was brought up in Leicestershire I think I might be stretching it to say it was a crime family. Definitely, there was definitely some bad behaviour going on over that side. And so you wouldn't want to get into a punch-up with him, but he can be really warm and kind. And I made an album with him. He asked me to produce his record. It's called One More Time for Peace, I think that was called. And so we spent loads of time together doing all the pre-production, and then we went and recorded it with a bunch of great guys. And so I know him very well, and I'm really very fond of him. But he's becoming a bit more of a recluse. Mm-hmm. He always was a bit of a recluse. But he's a great guy and a hell of a singer. Really fantastic. Good.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Definitely. And then after that, we have to mention Steve Harley with the Cockney Rebel, the reformed Cockney Rebel, weren't you, for five years. And you've mentioned the guitar there. I mean, that solo, it's instantly memorable. Everyone can recognise it as soon as they hear it. Steve himself says it's not an easy solo to play. And the recording as well was maybe two or three takes that was kind of cut together. What's your memories of recording that song and that solo?
Well, it was at Abbey Road, at the Beatles studio, the one that we come down the stairs from the control room into the main recording room. And it was getting quite late, probably midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. I must have had at least a couple of drinks. That would be normal for me, especially to get towards the end of the session. I didn't think I was going to have to do any more because, we were now listening to vocals. So I can't remember what we were doing exactly, but anyway, somebody said, why don't you just try and stick that solo on? I said, okay. So for some reason, I picked up the acoustic guitar rather than the electric and had a crack at it. And I have to explain, back in those days, we were working on, I think, probably 24-track recording. Yeah. So most of the tracks were already filled up. So I think there were two tracks left for me. So I could I could get two takes at it, and you had to then start throwing things away. You know, if you didn't like the take, you threw it away. There was no point keeping that and trying to use bits out of that. You couldn't do that. You can in Pro Tools now. So I think I played the first part of it pretty well straight off the bat, right off the top of my head, and then I was struggling to get the second half. So I had two or three goes maybe at that, but we threw them away, and then on the track two, then I had a front and a back. And we put the two of them together, and that was it. It didn't take very long, probably 20 minutes, maybe less. Fantastic. Well, I do my best work when I'm not done what I'm doing. when I'm not thinking is one of the things that ruins music.
I love that.
if you're like me, you're self-taught. I play best when I'm slightly... you have to allow inspiration to arrive.
Yes.
Okay? And inspiration doesn't come through thought.
No, it comes naturally, logic. Doesn't it?
Yeah. It comes another way. That's, that's why pretty well anybody could write a song. It's just getting out your own way.
Yeah.
It's not that difficult once you figure out you shouldn't be judging yourself all the time I have done some solos. There's a solo on one of Rod's songs where I just couldn't get it. And so I said, listen, leave me alone for 10, 15 minutes. And I'll work something out. And I worked out a nice melodic part. And it was quite a nice, solo. I played it on a nylon guitar. I can't remember the song now. And I was quite pleased with it. But it was I learned it. Mm-hmm. You know, and this was the other way around. I've had to learn it after I played it. That's a bit strange. That sounds really Irish, doesn't it? I am Irish, so loud.
And with Steve saying that the solo itself is a really difficult one, he says in later incarnations of the band, and when he tours with it in later years, he's always had to make sure he's got a top-notch guitar player to actually play this, because people expect it to sound a certain way. So do you remember it being difficult to, as you said, learn what you'd played in the studio back when you were doing it live?
No, because I made it up, it falls to my hands in a very natural way. So, no, so it you know, you've got to have a certain facility to be able to do it. But I didn't find it particularly difficult. I find it quite hard sometimes. I mean, I still make mistakes. I'm one of those guys that, as I said, I don't really know what I'm doing. I don't even know how I know how to play the guitar. That's the truth. If I think about it, I can't play the bloody thing. And sometimes I'm so wretched, because I play every morning when I get up. I've got a routine where I have a cup of coffee and I sit and I play the guitar for an hour or so, just when I'm in that kind of not quite awake and definitely not asleep. And I find in that kind of twilight period that I find new things to do. So I know this sounds daft. How can you surprise yourself? I mean, you're the one that's there. That shouldn't be something you even think. But that's really what happens. You play something you've never played before, and you don't know how you play it. Why did I play that? Why did my hands go there? That's the inspiration part, I guess.
Indeed, you never know when the muse strikes, do you?
Absolutely. No, you don't. It's true. Yeah. Who's keeping an eye out for him or
that's
her?
That's it. And after having, well, the number one and all those hits with Steve, you then left to join Rod Stewart, who you've mentioned a couple of times there. I mean, how did that chance come about?
Well, I guess I really owe that one to Steve. Maybe even another step is Linda Lewis, who was my wife at that time, a great singer, a great artist. And in fact, funny enough, I went to see Rod Stewart Tuesday night, that's a couple of nights ago, and at the O2. And there was a picture up of him wearing some outlandish outfit that he'd put up for fun. And in the background was Linda Lewis. And I said to my daughter who was with me, I said, look, there's Linda. And at that point, he broke into Do You Think I'm Sexy? And the high melody of that riff, which is Linda singing. So I had two goes at Linda that night, you know, two moments to think about her. So she was doing a record and Cat Stevens was producing it. And I'm sorry about all the name dropping, but unfortunately these are the people involved. So he was doing this session and he wanted to produce a couple of tracks for Linda. So he wanted to do it in LA, and we were living in England, and he called me up and he said, I'd like you to play guitar on it. I said, great, okay. So Lynn and I nip over to LA, and we cut the tracks. I think we cut three. And I was playing with some great players, some of those guys over there, Ollie Brown and Willie Weeks. And, oh, God, they were great. I mean, I was so out of my depth. I was bricking it. Anyway, I get my parts done and it seems all right, and then Linda's going to do some vocals, so I've got the afternoon off. So I'd bumped into Rod Stewart some time earlier, and I thought, you know, he's putting a band together, I should give him a call. So I called him, and he wasn't there, and Britt Eklund answered the phone, which was even better. And I said, okay, I'm looking for Rod Stewart. You give him this number and ask him to call me back if he's still looking for a guitar player. And he called back, and I got an audition the next day and got the job. So I know why the Steve Harley connection was that he'd seen me play with Steve Harley at the Roxy. He came to the Roxy just because he likes to go and see what's going on.
Yeah.
And saw me play, and obviously thought, I think he liked the hat I was wearing. I think that was the reason for the job.
Wear a good hat in future.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I used to wear one of those sort of flat caps, you know, the Peaky Blinders thing.
Yes, indeed. What was the... Well, obviously, it couldn't have been that much of a difficult decision to decide to join Rod, given everything. But how difficult was it leaving Steve on the back of the success and the relationship you built up with him?
Yeah, well, that was awful, that part. And It's so ironic how these things turn out. Steve was the only writer in Cotton Rebel, and there was no room for me to write. And as I explained earlier, you know, songwriting has been part of my life forever. So I missed out on the opportunity to first of all, to be make that creative contribution to the band, but also because, you know, if financially, if you get a hit, it's kind of a pension. Steve will tell you about Make Me Smile. So when Rod asked me if I joined the band, I said, will there be any writing? And he said, absolutely. He said, we'll be writing within the band. He wanted in those days to not recreate the Faces, but to carry the spirit of the Faces he wanted to carry forward, you know, because he liked, back in those days, it was 1976, he'd mostly been in bands. You know, he'd been in the Jeff Beck group and the Faces followed that. And before that, he was in bands like Steam Packet. And so he was not Rod Stewart's solo artist. That came later. But when he put this band together, he wanted that feeling. So, I started writing with him, you know, pretty well as soon as we got the first few gigs out of the way. And we were touring an album called A Night on the Town. So we were playing those tunes for the first few months, and then we went to the studio and made our own record. And that had Hot Legs on it and You're in My Heart and a bunch of hits, really. It was a good record. It was loads of fun. I mean, the Faces were probably, well, every musician's, well, not every musician, but many musicians' favourite bands, because they seemed to be having such a good time doing it. And I saw them, I thought, oh, God, I'd love to be in that band. There's no way I'd get rid of Ronnie Wood. And somehow Ronnie Wood got rid of himself.
Absolutely. Speaking of that band that Rod put together, I mean, as I said, I spoke to Carmine Appice a couple of times here on Vintage Rock Pod. He's been a great guest a few times, and he had so much fun playing with Rod, and he still speaks very fondly of that time with you guys. And just as you mentioned there about the songwriting, it really was, it was almost open the floor and bring me ideas, wasn't it? It does sound like a great kind of melting pot for ideas to blossom and grow.
Yes, of course. You would bring songs into Rod that were sometimes only half formed. And my favorite way to write was actually just sitting down in the room and start from scratch. That's my favorite way to work. There's a guy called B.A. Robertson who I was very friendly with in America, and he said to me, I should put this around the other way. I was off to Nashville. At this point, I'd stopped touring with Rod, and I was a staff writer for Universal. And Universal had sent me down to Nashville for a week to write. And I said to BA, I haven't done one of these before. I'm a bit nervous about it. I said, I'm going to have a couple of songs, you know, in my back pocket, and, you know, in case I run into trouble and I haven't got any ideas. And he said, oh, I never do that. He said, that's a terrible idea. I went, really? He said, you go down there with absolutely nothing, a blank sheet of paper. And he says, you go to the edge of the cliff and you jump off. It's a leap of faith. Wow. I said, well, okay. And so I did, and wrote, you know, several songs down there, none of which ever turned into anything, because it's a bit of an odd way to work in the first place. But that's what I used to like working with Rod, just sit in the room and play a chord and then make up a melody.
With all the songs that you wrote with Rod, I mean, do you have any favourites that stand out for you?
Definitely Forever Young. Yeah. And there's some album tracks that I'm very fond of. The Best Days of My Life is one I like. Yeah. Never Give Up on a Dream, which we gave the royalties to the Terry Fox Foundation. That's that guy who had cancer in his leg and had his leg amputated. He was an athlete. And bless him, I mean, what a guy. He then decided to raise money for cancer. He would run across Canada. Not walk, run across Canada with one leg. I mean, what a man. What a man. And sadly, the cancer came back on that journey and it claimed him before he finished.
Oh, no.
It was a tragic story, but, I mean, what an inspiration. So Ron and I wrote this song called Never Give Up on a Dream.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so there's quite a few little songs lying around that weren't hits, but I'm very fond of Brighton Beach. I wrote with him a few years back now, and that was his reintroduction to songwriting again. He stopped writing for about 15 years. I went round his house one day because he and I are really, really old friends. So we've been mates for 40 odd years. I went round his house and I had a guitar with me. I think it was at his request. I don't know why he asked me to bring a guitar. Obviously it was to pretend to write. So we sat down after lunch, and just as I suggested, the fun way to do it is to sit together and come up with something. And I played a few chords, and he suddenly started to sing, and I followed his melody, and he followed my chords, and suddenly we've got a song. That's the way. It's that easy or that
I love
difficult?
that.
Choose one, tick one
It's that
box.
easy. It's that easy. Just touching on something that you mentioned in a previous interview, you said one of your highlights of your career was playing in Rio with Rod. I think you said you'd never felt such energy. Can you talk to us about that day and that experience you had?
There's something about an enormous crowd. They bring something to you that you're not going to get any other way when you get on a stage in front of, hundreds of thousands of people. I want to point out this is not the Guinness Book of Records, 3 million people on whatever that beach was,
Copacabana.
Copacabana Beach. Yeah. This is Rock in Rio, which was, I don't know, 300,000 people. It was huge. You couldn't from the stage, you could not see where they finished. It was unbelievable. And something went wrong with one of my guitars, and I actually ended up not playing for a bit and just singing backgrounds. And I felt so comfortable up there in front of all those people. I didn't care. It wasn't like, oh my God, I just sang, and just loved. There was a great amount of love and affection on that in that space. And I really like those. I really like those enormous gigs. It comes with its own difficulties. But there's no sound check because you can't have a sound check.
Of course.
So you rely on your crew immensely, who are that touring level. They are very, very experienced and really great. I mean, the crew, I can't say enough great things about road crew, because they are great fun and they're really, really dedicated. And they have a tough job. They've got to be sometimes setting up at 8 in the morning, and they don't tear down till gone midnight. This is brutal, but they're fantastic.
Absolutely.
I always love the crew that I've worked with.
Absolutely. And just moving on from kind of the playing and the recording to the producing side of things as well. I mean, you worked with London Choir Boys, and I've got a big North American listenership who know Glass Tiger, of course, and you worked with them, and they won plenty of awards. What was that like working with them at that time?
Oh, it was great. It was great. Lovely guys. In fact, I went up to Canada and wrote with Sam Reed, their keyboard player. I wrote a few songs with him. I don't know what happened to those. They might have been on one of the records. And Alan Frew, the lead singer, and he and I became quite good mates. And that's how we got Rod to sing on the Glass Tiger song, one of the ones that I wrote. I think I've got a production credit on as well, called My Town. And because Alan, being Scottish, and Rod's, this all taking place in LA, where I lived in LA for 22 years. And they just bonded immediately over football and Scotland and all. I mean, he's such a Celtic, well, it's a Celtic football, but he's got a Celtic heart, Rod, even though he's half London. Rod said, "Why have you asked me to sing on this?" That was how he put it. "Why have you asked me?" And I said, "Well, I didn't think a record company would let you. It's not the same label." And he said, "No, I can fix that." He said, "I want to sing on it." So we came down and sang, and it was a hit. What can you do? You can't keep him out of the room.
Fantastic.
No way, I'm busy. Stop it.
And all the names that we've heard. Just one thing. I heard somewhere once that apparently Phil Lynott approached you to be part of Thin Lizzy at some point as well.
He did. Drinking in the speakeasy bar, which was favourite hangout. I met him several times. He's a lovely, lovely guy. And he asked me if I wanted to do it, and I said, I think I'm doing something else. It wasn't that I didn't want the job. I would have been happy to have the job. But there's a friend of mine called Snowy White, who's a guitar player.
Of course, yeah.
And for some reason, whenever I didn't want a job or I couldn't do it, I'd say, oh, but you need, and fill in this gap. And so Snowy got the job, not only with he played with me in Cockney Rebel for a little while, but he didn't like me. He's a blues guitar player and has how shall I put this? He really knows what he likes and what he doesn't like, and he's quite particular about it. And I've got so much respect for him. He's a great player. He's a very dear friend. But he left Cockney Rebel because he didn't really want to play that stuff. Then he got the job with Thin Lizzy, and then somebody approached me about playing with Gilmour in the Pink Floyd. I said, no, I'm busy, but the guy you want is filling this blank. And so he played with Pink Floyd for quite a long time. And then he went on to be the guitar player with the bass player. What's his name? The bass player in the Pink Floyd started his own band.
Oh, Roger Waters.
Roger Waters, that's right. Yeah. He played with Roger Waters for 18 years. Okay. So I should have taken a percentage because that would be really handy.
Bit of an agent fee, maybe, something like that.
Introduction fee.
I just love how you're too busy to play with Pink Floyd. That's just phenomenal.
Well, I think I was already going, I already had a tour booked or something.
Just one more funny thing that I've got to hear from you. And a legend, shall we say, Etta James. She spent a whole recording session flirting with you. Is that correct?
Yes, a bit. Yes. It was quite strange. But the difficult part for me, so there was a song that I wrote with Robin Le Mesurier and Bernie Taupin, because we had a little band together called Farm Dogs, which, died a very sad, death without anybody even noticing we were around. And we'd written this lovely song called Stars and Seeds. And it's a beautiful, sort of lovely idea from Bernie. The idea was that a star would fall from heaven, and from that, and it would be in the form of a seed, and the seed would grow a tree, and you could climb that tree and get to heaven, climbing the tree. So it was a great idea, lovely idea. So I got all these people together to sing a verse each and join in on the chorus. Etta James and Mavis Staples, from the Staples Singers, and Joe Cocker, and a host of really lovely people. So I get to produce this thing, because I'm the co-writer on it. And I was working at the time as a staff producer for BMG. Excuse me. They don't have staff producers anymore, but it was a great job. Mm-hmm. So I get Etta in the room, and she's warming up, and she's belting. She's belting. And then she stops belting and she sings softly for a bit. And then she goes back to belting. And so when we start to record the track, she's arrived with an entourage of about six people. and I'm this little white kid behind the glass. And she was lovely. She was lovely. But I liked her singing softly rather than hard. She was going through it. She'd done a couple of takes. And I had to say, Etta, I'm really sorry. And I've got to tell Etta James that she's not doing it right. And the balls it took for me to make that statement were enormous. I wish I'd kept them. So I go out and tell her, She said something like, "Honey, you're my little blonde angel. I'll do anything you ask," or something along those lines. She was unbelievably charming. Still flirting away at whatever age she was. She was not young at this point. She would have been, well into her 70s, and I was probably in my 40s. But she did as I asked, and it was beautiful.
Incredible.
It's a funny job that producing, because you've got to go with your instincts. You can't. Mm-hmm. You have to do what you think is right for the record. I mean, telling Rod he's out of tune, I mean, that's fun. You do that again, it's not quite perfect, because those days were no, I'm talking about recording on tape.
Yes.
You've got to get it right. And he paid me a nice compliment. He said that I would get more out of him as a singer than anybody else when I was in the control room. I think because he trusted my instincts. I think that was probably what was going on. And I there would just be the engineer and he and I. And made a few records like that. It was good. He's a great singer though. He really is.
He's
got very good instincts. He's got great timing, a fabulous sound, and phrasing. His phrasing's great. He's not a bad writer either.
Not bad indeed. Not bad indeed.
No,
now we've thrown around so many names, incredible names, and there's so many more that we've not even mentioned. Is there anybody that you've not worked with yet that you would love to work with in future?
Billie Eilish.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a huge fan. I love the way she makes records. That's not going to happen. There's no chance of that happening at all. But, if you're going to dream, I would dream. I would love to work with her. I just like the way she thinks.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, Ed Sheeran. I like Ed Sheeran's work. There's not much room there. There's not much room for production with these guys because they all do it in-house. And it's part of who they are as artists is the production work.
Yeah.
They're not just guys like Tom Jones who probably has the orchestra and all the band all queued up and he just walks in and sings. That's where I could be useful, putting the band together and doing that sort of stuff. But those are two names that I think of at the moment.
Fantastic stuff. Well, Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. Loved hearing all your stories. Again, we'll reiterate just to make sure everyone gets out there and has a listen to or buys a physical copy of that wonderful Christmas song. If you just want to remind us a little bit about that just to finish the interview.
Yeah, When a Child is Born, it's available on all platforms. You can download it from Apple and Amazon. And the money from this will go to the charity I was speaking about, the Suicide Awareness Charity.
Yeah, very good call.
It's a grown-up subject, suicide awareness. And one of the reasons that almost nobody does it is because it's not a subject that people want to talk about. Mm-hmm. So we have a word, and we should finish with this word. It's called suicidance. And suicidance means exactly what it says on the tin. People don't want to talk about suicide, but you need to talk to people who are in trouble. So during Christmas, keep your eye out for those lonely ones that family have gone or for whatever reason, and reach out to them and keep them in your thoughts.
Absolutely. A lovely message to finish with. Jim, absolute pleasure chatting with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, you're most welcome. I had a great time. Thanks.
And a big thanks to Jim Cregan there. Please support him and the Angel Force charity. If you can spare a couple of pounds or dollars or euros, check out Cregan & Co's When a Child is Born. Jim was such a humble guy, wasn't he? And I love the part where he tried to phone Rod Stewart and Britt Eklund answered. Totally natural, of course. Now, Jim is the kind of guy you could do a real deep dive conversation with, spend a good couple of hours really getting into his career. I mean, we barely scratched the surface, but I hope you enjoyed the chat with him. Right, now's the time of the programme for the top fives, and this week it's going to be the top five Rod Stewart songs. But first, looking back on last week's top five Supertramp songs, I've got to say I was quite surprised to only receive one bit of feedback on my selection. Usually I get well into double figures, but you were all pretty quiet on me last week, so I'm taking that to mean that you all completely, wholeheartedly agree with my choices. The only person to actually get in touch was Hugh Flaherty, I think that's how you say it, who said that the Logical Song is an absolute classic and has to be at number one. Other than that, he'd have Goodbye Stranger in his top five, along with Take the Long Way Home. He also said A Shout for School in his list too. Thanks for that, Hugh. So, to this week's choices then. Rod Stewart. I'm sticking to his solo work, so not including the Faces material in this. Remember, it's my personal selection. I don't expect you to agree with them all, and I really would love to hear from you with your thoughts on my picks and your own selections as well, so I can give you a mention on next week's show. So here you go. My favourite five songs from Rod Stewart. At five is a hit from his A Night on the Town album. The single reached number two in the UK charts in 1976. It's a story of a gay friend who was murdered, a brave subject in the mid-70s. It's a great song, thought-provoking. At number five is The Killing of Georgie. Another kid, a switchblade knife, who did not intend to take his life. He just pushed his luck a little too far that night. And number four is actually a cover, originally recorded by Tom Waits in the mid-80s. Rod's version featured Jeff Beck and was a big hit, number one in Canada, three in the US, top 10 in the UK in 1990. And number four is Downtown Train. Number three is a great song, number one in the UK in 1972, from his Never a Dull Moment album. It's another brilliant vocal performance from Rod on this one, one of his absolute classics. And number three is You Wear It Well. And you wear it well. Madame O'Ness has gotten. Number two comes from his Tonight I'm Yours album. It was released in 1981, and with its strong 80s sound and new wave feel, it paved the way for Rod into a new generation. It's a great upbeat number. Young Hearts, Be Free Tonight. And number two is Young Turks. And at number one is an absolute classic. It's a song everybody knows, young or old, with some great storytelling in the lyrics. It was his first mega hit and is probably still his signature song today. The undoubted number one song from Rod Stewart, in my opinion, from the Every Picture Tells a Story album, is Maggie May. Wake up, Maggie, so there you go, my top five songs from Rod Stewart's solo career. So many other big songs missing out, of course, but I don't really need to list them. But I would love to hear what you think. What do you think I got right? What do you think I got wrong? Message me on the social media platforms or email me, vintagerockpod@gmail.com, and I'll give you a readout on next week's show. Well, that's it for me on this week's big interview show. Thanks again for listening. Make sure you subscribe to Vintage Rock Pod on your podcast app and on YouTube as well. It's a growing channel with the interviews in video form. You can get to see me, which is not great, but you get to see the fantastic guest I interview, which is much better indeed. Anyway, I'll be back tomorrow with another This Day Rocks episode featuring a man who was playing in one of the biggest bands of the 70s. But until then, take care.